Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic Podcast. On Sundays, we take a deeper dive into these ancient topics with excerpts from the Stoic texts, audiobooks that we like here or recommend here at Daily Stoic, and other long-form wisdom that you can chew on this relaxing weekend. We hope this helps shape your understanding of this philosophy, and most importantly, that you're able to apply it to your actual life. Thank you for listening. Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next listen recommendations to habituate every type of thriller listener. The time is now more than ever to embrace breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that have enthralled you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped. My wife and I have both been raving about this book, Furious Hours, which is this true crime story that lo and behold, involves Harper Lee. And then even though I've been raving about the book for years and years, my wife finally listened to it on Audible. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. I think I've told you this before, but I hate sitting in my chair. I'm sitting in this chair, recording this right now. I sit in my chair when I write, but if I'm on the phone, I'm walking. That's actually why I hate Zoom. Like, I hate that from the pandemic, like, everything is now, let's do a Zoom call, and they expect you to be in a thing with books behind you. Like, I'm like, no, I want to be moving, man, or I want to be driving. I don't want the dead time of I could be doing some other thing that's good for me or crossing something off the list. And instead, I'm having to pretend like I care what the person I'm talking to about this administrative thing is looking like while we're doing it. So anyways, I love walking. So I did my first walking episode of this podcast. I gave a talk in Austin downtown. Where was it? The JW, I think, to Q2, the bank. And it was a great talk. I'll probably put some chunks of the Q&A on the podcast at some point. But a special guest popped by. He was in town to do Rogan's podcast, the one and only Stephen Pressfield. We recently ran an excerpt from his pod. Just one of my all-time favorite people, a mentor, a person who's changed my life in so many ways, whose books I cannot recommend highly enough. Anyway, Stephen popped by to see the talk. And then I said, hey, why don't we just, you've been on the podcast in every format imaginable. We did a downstairs one at the Painted Porch. He did an in-person podcast before the Painted Porch even existed, but I just got in the space. We've done remote, you know, on all the different platforms. Anyways, I said, why don't we just walk and we'll record? There was some mic issues at first, but we had some nice backup. So anyways, I think the audio here is good enough. He and I went for about a 30-minute walk along Town Lake, one of my favorite places, which I don't get to see enough, not being in the city anymore. But here is Stephen Pressfield and I talking. He was in town to promote a new book that he just published called Government Cheese. It's his memoir, but I really like the book. It's sort of like, it's the stories in between the lessons that make Turning Pro and The War of Art and all his other books so fantastic. He's had a hell of a life. He taught school, drove tractor trailers, worked in advertising, was a screenwriter. He worked on offshore oil rigs, picked fruit. He was in the Marines. He says he's had 21 different jobs in 11 states, and it took him almost 30 years to publish his first novel. So it's quite a story. And do check out Government Cheese. We've got signed copies of all his books in the Painted Porch, which I will link to. You can follow him on Instagram at Stephen_Pressfield. Follow him on Twitter at Stephen Pressfield. His website, stephenpressfield.com. Just one of my absolute favorite people, and excited to bring him back on the podcast. Check out his new book, Government Cheese, and all of his books, and enjoy this walk and talk with me and Stephen Pressfield.
I saw that you did a thing on Instagram where you said the two things or the three things I learned from Tim Ferriss.
Yes.
And I wanted to say a couple things that I learned from you.
Oh, okay.
To give you some props here.
All right, I'll take it.
When I was really trying to get my feet on the ground, self-publishing and stuff like that, you were kind enough to let me come here for a day and spend a day with me and kind of tell
that
me
was right,
some stuff. You know?
Right when I'd gotten the building, but the bookstore hadn't started. Yes, you were like the first person to see it.
And the first thing you said to me that of course I knew, but that really was hammered home, was that if you're a writer or an entrepreneur or any kind of an artist and you do your thing, that's only half of it.
Yeah.
The marketing is something that is on you, motherfucker.
Yeah.
Because even if you're with a mainstream publisher, which is absolutely true for me, they don't do anything for you.
No.
Whatever it is, you've got to do.
Yeah.
So here we are doing this walk and talking thing right now. This is, from my point of view, aside from the fun of seeing you, this is marketing.
Yeah,
you know, this is the work.
Yeah.
And for me, like for most artists or creative people, I think it's not natural. It's not my wheelhouse. It's not my comfort zone.
Sure.
So it's a real thing where you got to force yourself through your own resistance. We're walking up a hill now, by the way.
No, it feels like it's turning you into a salesperson, which is weird and uncomfortable. But then the way I kind of think about it, too, is it's like, if you won't be the salesperson for your work, what does that say about what you think of your work?
Exactly. And this is from your book, Perennial Seller, and which everybody should read.
Oh, thank you.
Because you really sort of give an ass-kicking, you know, a few pages in there about how if you don't do it.
Yeah.
And the way I look at it, particularly with fiction, I've got to defend my characters.
Yeah.
You know, there are these people here that people should know about.
They're your baby.
And I've got to be their champion because they can't do it themselves.
Right.
So it's hard, but anybody who's listening to this, you know, psych yourself up and do it. And the other thing you told me, you know, when you're a creative writer or whatever it is, and you do something once, you think, well, okay, I've done that. I can't repeat myself. That would be cheating.
Sure.
And you said immediately, wrong. You know, whatever, if you've done something, repurpose it.
Yeah.
Do it again. A chapter in a book can become a blog post, can become an article on Medium, can become a video, can become all kinds of things, because only the thinnest sliver of people actually see it the first time. It's not like people are going, oh, Orion did this, now he's repeating himself. So that was another big breakthrough for me, to think that you can repeat yourself, and it's just another slice of the pie that you're getting out there.
Well, I've gotten that from...
thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate it. And all of that is stuff that in some one way or another I got from someone else, so I feel like you're always just paying it forward. But, like, so yeah, someone... I remember with one of my books, I sent out... So I, you know, built the email list, which you're supposed to do, and I sent out, like, one email about it, right? And I was like, that should be enough. And then someone was like, but if you only talk about it... First off, you're, like, assuming that everyone saw it, which they didn't. But if you only talk about it one time, what is that saying to people about how important you think it is?
Yes.
Right? And so that was helpful. And then I was actually talking to Gary Vaynerchuk once. And you know, I actually really like Gary, and he's been great to me. But he said, he's like, I have seven things that I say. And he's like, everything I do is cycling through those seven things. Like I say, he says I say them in different ways. I say them in different contexts. You know, I say them in a short way and a long way. But his point was, like, he has his, like, seven messages, his, like, seven themes or whatever they are, and he goes through them. And I think, you know, people sometimes think, like, well, I said this once, so I can't do it again. And the reality is most people haven't seen it, right? And most people, if they have seen it, it's not like it sunk in and immediately change their life. They have to hear it in different ways, right? And so this is something I was just talking about in my talk, which is, like, people would complain, academics have complained about meditations, that Marcus Aurelius repeats himself. And it's like, let's not get hit by this bike. he's repeating himself because it's important.
Right.
And because even though he understands it intellectually, he still needs to be reminded of it each time. Like, I read The War of Art whenever I'm starting a creative project. I already know what's in it. I've read it a lot of times. But something pops out at me in a new, like, you know, like, even though I've read the book or I've read the other books or I know you, you still get something new out of it each time. And that's why, like, even if you are repeating word for word the same thing, it can land with someone differently. The algorithm could show it to a new person for the first time. So I think it's just, I think actors have to deal with this more than writers, I think, but self-consciousness is the enemy, right? When you're thinking about how other people are going to think of you, or you're worried about embarrassing yourself or debasing yourself or demeaning yourself, what you're really doing, that's a form of resistance too, I think, because it's preventing you from potentially reaching people that you could reach, and your mind is saying, well, like, no, it's better to be shy about it or quiet about it. But you actually do have to put yourself out there.
Yes. I mean, it is like if we were an advertising agency and we were selling Preparation H, we would know you got to have a campaign and you got to hit it again and again and again and again and again. Yeah,
exactly.
So anyway, I just wanted to thank you for taking the time to help me out on that and open my eyes to some stuff.
Well, speaking of repetition, an unexpected character in the new book is Steven Seagal. He appears multiple times in your memoir, which if I had to guess, like, who are some of the characters in a Pressfield memoir, I'm not sure that's who I would have guessed.
Well, you know, Above the Law, the movie, Steven Seagal's first movie, was, you know, I was one of the writers on that. And so he's such a colorful character and says so many colorful things that I wanted to put him in there and give him his due.
He said nice things about your house?
Yes. Not really.
No. Well, no, I thought it was funny because it's like, even like you have this moment of vanity from him where you're like doing this scene and he goes like, no, I don't look good in the desert. So you can't have that scene. But there is like a remarkable amount of awareness in that statement too, where he's like, he knows what his strengths are. He knows what his craft is. And he's like, these are the conditions that it works in.
It is kind of one thing that sort of was amazing to me in the working in the movie business was when you think of your, you know, how does a movie get made?
Sure.
How does the story come together? And a lot of times, like on Above the Law, we're sitting with Andy Davis, who's the director, and he says one day, we gotta have a foot chase. And I thought, what the hell is that?
You know?
And he says, think about the French Connection, you know, where Gene Hackman is in a Santa Claus suit and he's chasing down a bad guy. Yeah. So a lot of these things are not scenes in movies, are not coming from out of any philosophical or scientific concept. It's like, what are we missing? We don't have a torture scene. We don't have a scene where the hero gets the crap beaten out of him by the bad guy. And that's a lot of the way it happens. So that's part of the stuff in there.
Well, no, I like that, too. You were talking about how, as you were starting, you were kind of both disappointed but also fascinated with the way that some of these people would just rip off old plots and themes, which seems to be kind of the ultimate, like, through line in a lot of your work, which I've gotten from you, which is you sort of mine these old plots or archetypes or classical stories and you put your own spin on them. But like what they were doing with these old plots, that's what you did with Bagger Vance in the Bhagavad Gita. And the idea that you can take, what is it, new wine and old skins, or the expression that you can sort of reuse these things. That's it's also what Shakespeare is doing.
Yes. There's no shame. And this took me, it's kind of like what we were just talking about. There's no shame in taking something that already exists and then putting a spin on it or making it different. Like, I know you're like Xenophon's The Persian Expedition, which is a story, a true story of this Greek army that went 3 months into the interior of the Persian Empire, lost a battle, and had to fight their way back out.
Yes.
That became the movie The Warriors in 19-whatever it was, and it was terrific. And I have thought myself, how could I do that in outer space? Or was there another way to do it? Because it's just a classic story.
Yes.
Like Romeo and Juliet, you can do over and over and over, you know? And anything that will get you started and get some sort of, so you can put a spin on something, there's no shame in that at all.
It's weird. Sometimes people criticize my work. They go, he's just, you know, rehashing what the Stoics say or just popularizing what the Stoics say. And they I think they think that that's an insult, and maybe that is an insult to a certain type of writer that sees themselves as some sort of bold, visionary groundbreaker. Uh-huh. And I'm like, you got it. You nailed exactly what I, like, you are, you think you are criticizing me, but you're actually telling me that I achieved what I was trying to achieve, which is take an old idea and make it accessible to new people.
But also for you, this Stoicism and Marcus Aurelius and meditations, it is coming from your soul in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not like, oh, I found a property that I'm going to exploit. Yeah. Yeah, this is something I think you are evolving. I really want to see where you're going to be 10 years from now and what you're going to be doing, because this is sort of flowing through you right now, and it doesn't seem to have any end at the moment, but I'm sure that it's going to evolve into something that we couldn't predict right now. And I'd be very interested to see what that's going to be.
Well, don't you feel like, going back to our conversation about like what you owe the characters from a marketing standpoint, I think one of the reasons that I feel okay marketing and selling the stuff and I don't feel super self-conscious about it is that I feel like I owe a debt to the stuff because it's not mine, right? Like this, I have this sign on, I wrote it on like a little note card next to my desk, and it just says like, are you being a good steward of Stoicism? Because like I didn't invent the stuff and it was given to me, right? Like in the sense that it was introduced to me, but also the fact that I'm now associated with it is not a thing that I necessarily, that's also a gift. That's a gift from the market, that's a gift from the algorithm, that's a thing that happened, right? And so now that I am associated with it, I have to think about, you know, how am I using the success? How am I using the access? How am I using the association? And am I doing it in a way that benefits primarily me? Or am I doing it in a way that serves the stuff? So when you get visited by the muses, they are giving you something. And then the question is, are you doing them justice or honor? Or are you, well, you know, it was creatively fulfilling for me, and that's the end of it. Like, I kind of think about it that way also.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, you're talking in terms of existing material from the year, whatever year it was. But it's true for fiction as well.
Sure.
Well, for anything that's totally creative, that's coming to you from some other source. That's a gift as well.
Totally.
And you have to be a steward of that just as well.
Yeah, and that's why I think, you know, this that holds true in how you actually do it day to day. Like, are you showing up and writing and working and doing all that, or are you kind of procrastinating and putting it all off? And then also, you know, once it exists, are you like, well, I hope it works, or are you really fighting for it and trying to give it a chance to succeed and reach an audience?
Yeah. And like you were asking before, what government cheese that phrase meant in this book of mine, it falls into the exact same category. Like when I was driving trucks and delivering surplus food to poor communities, i.e. government cheese, I felt like I'm a steward.
Yeah.
I'm delivering a load, and it's exactly like writing or anything else, you know, that it's not, I didn't invent this government cheese.
Right.
I didn't load this trailer. But my job, like a writer's job, is to deliver this load to people. And it's, again, speaking of ego is the enemy.
Yeah.
Ego is not part of this. You know, one of the things that was interesting about delivering those loads back in the day was that they never, you were always referred to by the people you were delivering to, which was churches.
Oh.
As driver. Nobody ever said, Ryan, could we give you a, you know, a glass, a cup of coffee or something? It was always like, driver, would you pull in over there? And then you would sort of step to the side. And that, I thought, was exactly the way it should be. That you're a steward of this material, but it's not your material, you know?
Yeah.
And when you're done and you have that empty trailer and you sweep it out and you close the doors, that's a hell of a good feeling.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
That's really interesting. I like that. Right. And someone's depending on it, and it'll go bad if you don't get there in a certain amount of time. And
it's food that you're putting on people's tables, you know, which is hopefully what you're doing with Stoicism or any of the books that you're writing, the Four Cardinal Virtues. A lot of people take that in, and this changes their lives, you know, or reinforces them or encourages them, including me.
Well, I kind of think about that even with the Daily Stoic and the Daily Dad, which I do, which is I'm a big believer in committing to certain outputs, right? Like, so some people think I do too much, but I think part of the reason that I'm able to do as much as I have is that if you say, hey, I'm doing a daily email, then people start to anticipate it. It's a thing. And you have to beat the expectations that you've set. I think for a lot of creative people or entrepreneurs, they're like, I'd like to start a company. And then there's no timetable. There's no urgency. Uh-huh. There's no expectation. Uh-huh. And so when you have unlimited time or space, it takes unlimited time or space. And so when I think about it, it's like, no. I am currently the producer of this daily thing. Uh-huh. I have to deliver that daily load or it doesn't happen.
How did you come to that?
I kind of backed into it accidentally. I think when Steve, who's my agent, suggested a daily book, I think I knew about the genre, but that wasn't like, you know, what I was really thinking of. But when he suggested it, what struck me, what was really interesting to me about it was what happens on the 366th day. Uh-huh. So you finish it and then what's next? And so I was interested in not the commitment of writing a book that was one page a day. I was interested in creating a thing that was one like thought per day. So I was interested in what you would build around the book. And that's what became like dailystoic.com and the email and all the social media. So I'm interested, like I function really well when I have like commitments like that. Like this is what I have to deliver on this. Like I do this every week, I do this every month. And then when I have that, it keeps me honest.
Were you always like that?
I think so. Like I'm someone like if I have to be somewhere at 7, like my whole thing is pivoting around that, you know, which I actually have to kind of like work on because it'll like, I'll be like, okay, I just like ruined my day because I had one evening appointment or whatever, which is also why I don't agree to a lot of stuff. Like, yeah, like if I have one phone call at 3, that means I don't have a free-flowing writing day because I'm thinking about what is this thing that I signed up for at 3, which means I have to be done by this at 2:15 to transition, you know, like the transition becomes this whole thing. Yeah. So I try, that's why I was showing in my talk, my ideal day is nothing scheduled in the calendar. If I have nothing scheduled in the calendar, I will write until I am done writing. If I have something in the
calendar. How do you know when you're done writing?
I think you know. You know what I mean? You know. Uh-huh. But I feel like if I have something scheduled, like, let's say I have an appointment at 10, then I'm only writing from 8 to 10. Uh-huh. And then the idea that I'll go back and pick it back up, it never happens. Uh-huh. So,
you know, there's a great, you probably have seen this, a letter from Charles Dickens to somebody that invited him for lunch.
Yeah.
And basically he says, just knowing that I'm having to have lunch with you is going to fuck up my entire morning,
exactly,
you know?
How it is,
and so that's why I can't have lunch with you. Sorry about that.
I basically don't schedule anything in the mornings for that reason. Every once in a while I do, or like this, like the talk I was paid for, you know what I mean? But I'm not, if someone's like, hey, I wanted to ask your advice on something, I'm like, that better be late in the afternoon. So like,
you're a believer of making before managing, correct?
Yes, yes, for sure. Are you?
I'm not, actually.
Oh, really?
I used to be.
Okay.
But somehow I now have so much to manage that I try to sort of get that out of the way so that I can then say, okay, now I'm going to write for the next 3 hours and that's it, you know? So, but I used to be that way.
See, I think the problem if you're like, I'm going to get it out of the way is like, let's say you do manage to successfully get it out of the way. It still took something out of you and then you don't have.
That's true.
I went through this the other day where like we were traveling. So like we were driving back. So I got to the office at noon and then I went to sit down and write. Uh-huh. And I called my wife and I was like, this was actually great that we did this. Because it's reminding me why I write in the morning. Because I was like 40% of who I'm capable of being sitting down, and I might as well just not have even been doing it. Uh-huh. American Apparel used to have these huge like factory sale. We would rent this whole thing out when I was here, and we would just sell like thousands and thousands of garments. Yes, this is the Mexican American Cultural Center or something, but we would rent this out for South by Southwest every year. That's how I first started coming to Austin, why I moved here.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed the book. I was telling you, I think it's sort of like, it's like showing the actual lesson or the thing you went through that got you to whatever gets reduced. You know, it's like the Hemingway thing where it's like the iceberg, you know, there's all the stuff underneath. Uh-huh. I feel like the book is like the stuff that led up to what is a very pithy, you know, like 400 word section in The War of Art or Turning Pro or whatever.
Interesting way of thinking of it. I never thought about that. But that is kind of what I wanted, because I think a lot of people are living in that lower part of the iceberg. We're all living that, right? And we don't think there is an upper part to it, but there is.
Yes.
If we just can believe in it. So I wanted to sort of write my lower part of the iceberg so that people could compare it to their own and say, okay, it's okay that I'm here below the surface.
Yeah.
Just bobbing along.
Well, yeah, and you, I think it you don't, whatever you're doing, whether you're an entrepreneur or a leader or a pastor or a writer or whatever, that all these experiences that you're having, one of the things Robert Greene told me once, he was like, the good thing about being a writer is that it's all material. Everything that happens to you, like the worst things that happen to you, the best things that happen to you, the humdrum, ordinary experiences, it all eventually fuels the material that you create. And I think this is true, like whatever it is that you do, we're like frustrated. We're like, well, this, you know, this is not good, or this pandemic's very disruptive to my business. But you're not thinking about how it's actually shaping who you'll be 10 years from now or 20 years from now. Or I think about this with like kids, like people I think are dramatically overstating the quote-unquote damage that the pandemic did to kids. But when you talk to someone who lived through the Depression or World War II, they're not like, oh, I was never the same. You know, those were the lost years. No, they
were the best years in a way, right?
Well, they're certainly that, but it shaped who they are now, and why you admire them is because of all those experiences.
Yeah, and it's not like those experiences become material literally.
Yeah.
Like literally you're not going to write about
the iceberg.
When you it's you know, it's changes that go on at a deeper level. And like the book, as you know, Government Cheese, is divided into like 7 books, and each one is named after a different person.
Yeah.
And each one was a mentor to me, and practically none of them were writing mentors. They were you know, and they didn't even know they were mentors, some of these people that I happened to meet, you know? But again, in the sense that it's material, it's more than that. It's what's making you whatever you are.
Well, people, because of some of the stuff I've written, people, you know, I get associated as an apprentice under Robert Greene.
Uh-huh.
And so people go like, I need to find an apprenticeship. And they're like, how did you, they'll say like, how did you become an apprentice to Robert Greene? And I try to explain to them, that's only the word that came to describe it after the fact, right? There was no like, there was no, like, it wasn't like in the old days where my father sold me to a candle maker as an apprentice for 7 years, right? Like, a lot of these sort of mentorship relationships, like I would recommend it. The thing gets, it just is what it is, slowly, steadily, and then in retrospect, you look back and you go, that person was a mentor of mine, that person changed my life, that person taught me X, Y, or Z. If you go around looking for these, like, official labels to put on it in the moment, you're probably actually closing yourself off to that.
Yes, I agree. The hero's journey is always acted out in a state of benightedness. You know, we never really know what the fuck we're doing, and that's probably exactly the way it should be.
Well, the writing mentor that I was most familiar with in the book, because I think he's in The War of Art, is who's the one when you lived?
Paul Rink.
Yes. Is he actually a writer?
Yes.
Because he connected you with his, what's his story?
He was a writer of what they would call young adult things right now, but he also had a bunch of novels that he had written.
Oh.
And he just, I knew him in a previous lifetime in this town.
Yeah.
And when I went to this town to write, he lived right down the street from me. And it's probably like Robert Greene with you. It just sort of happened.
Yeah.
We started having coffee every morning, and he knew my situation. I'm struggling to write my first book, finish it. And so he took me under his wing and told me what books to read and, you know, just kind of talked to me about the discipline in the writer's life and, you know, the self-command that you had to have, you know, and the relentless, merciless attitude you had to have with yourself. So he was a true writing mentor to me.
So those figures are so underrated, the ones, like, it's not necessarily what they taught you, you know, it's not this sort of, like, we think of, like, Obi-Wan, like, instructing Luke Skywalker and all this stuff. In retrospect, it's more like Obi-Wan's, like, here's a list of books, you should go read them, right? Like, it's
which is what you do for people, and which is great.
Yeah, but it's a less sexy process than you think it is, but a very critical one. Like, the interesting thing in at the beginning of Meditations, Marcus Aurelius thanks his philosophy teacher Rusticus not for so much what Rusticus taught him, but for lending him a copy of Epictetus. And so, like, it's not just the recommendation, of course, but it's also, does the person take the time to read the thing, right? Like, Paul could have given you the list of all these books, but, you know, it's the decision to actually read them and to reread them and to think about them and be open to them. That's what really changes the things, right? It's like when the student is ready, the teacher appears.
And also in his case, he kind of held me accountable to it. You know, it was like, have you read this? And then let's talk about it.
Yes.
But the other aspect of mentors too, thinking back to other ones in Government Cheese, is that sometimes they just model something for you, you know? It's just the way they live their life.
Yes.
You know, and you just say, I want to be like that guy. You know, I don't want to be like these other people. I want to be like that guy. And you watch him and you study him. And, was Robert Greene at all?
I was just going to say, that's totally what Robert was. In the way that would be like, I would call Robert and he wouldn't answer because Robert would be writing.
Yeah.
Or Robert would be like, I need you to drop this off, but like, don't even knock on the door. Just, like, put it outside the thing because, like, at 2 o'clock, I'll be in the middle. This will be where I am in my routine or my system. And, like, so watching, you know, when you watch someone that's very disciplined and respectful of their craft, I think it builds in you a kind of a reverence or a respect for that thing.
Yes. Because you see it so rarely, too.
Yes.
You know, it really stands out. You go, that's how this guy can do what he's doing.
Yes. Well, and it keeps you honest because you're like, well, if I disrespect the thing, they would be disappointed in me.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You sort of inherit their respect for the process or the craft of it, and then I think that's really important.
And there's some people you have in your life that all they have to do is give you a look.
Yes.
That look of disappointment, like you tell them, oh, yeah, I went to the wherever today, and they just look at you, and they go, oh, no, I feel so terrible.
Well, in Meditations, Marcus says that. He goes, you know, nothing is so inspiring as seeing the virtues you admire embodied in the people around you. And so if you kind of have the different people in your life who are what you aspire to be, I think you become like them. Epictetus says that. He says, if you live with a lame man, you will learn how to limp. You become that vibe. Versa. Yeah.
If you surround yourself with those people that you admire, you will become those people.
That's exactly right.
Should we stop right there? We
that
got back from our walk.
That's almost exactly 30 minutes.
Yes. All right. Great. It's a real pleasure.
I wish I could do all the podcast walks. It's so much better than sitting in a chair. Thanks so much for listening. If you could rate this podcast and leave a review on iTunes, that would mean so much to us and it would really help the show. We appreciate it, and I'll see you next episode. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.